What a wonderful meeting. You have an hour.
Thank you. Hi, my name is June. I'm an alcoholic. Hi. I want to thank the committee for inviting me a number of times and giving me the privilege of getting to be here. And I agree completely that, you know, and I feel all the pressure is off because you have already heard time and time again at this conference the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous and what it does and has done in the lives of the people who have shared and with the people that you've made friends with and gotten a chance to share with. You know, I really want to thank Sarah for taking the time to come all the way to Baltimore and pick me up. And I want to thank Mike and Matt for coming out here. And, yeah, this is Matt's first conference, and it's just really cool to get to spend time with someone that's at their first conference and get to know somebody new in Alcoholics Anonymous. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. It has given me a life that I never would have wanted, and it's made me... And it's made me a person that I wouldn't have even liked when I came here. And what's most interesting about that is that I was never a happy person. And most of the time, today, I'm pretty happy. Most of the time, and for a long time, I don't want to trade places with anybody. No matter what's going on, no matter how many bumps are going on in my road, I might, you know, want to eliminate a few bumps if I got those options. But I don't want to trade places, and I'm a person who always wanted to be someone else, look like someone else, feel like someone else, live like someone else. So it's just amazing. I think one of my favorite things that has happened to me over the years is I was talking at a conference back home. No, actually it wasn't a conference, it was just a meeting. And this guy came up to me afterwards to thank me for my talk, mostly because his sponsor was standing behind him and told him to. And he said, I want to thank you for your talk today. He said, I don't really believe that it was your story, but I like the way that you told it. And I love that for a number of reasons. But the main reason that I love that is that this guy actually doubted that I came from where I came from, that I used to live the way that I used to live, that I used to act and look the way that I used to look. And I thought, what a tribute to Alcoholics Anonymous. Because when I came in the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I looked exactly like my story. And I looked like it for a hell of a long time after I got here. You know, so I just think that's just an amazing thing, that this person could actually doubt, you know, where I came from. Whenever I'm asked to talk, I try to say a couple of things in the very beginning. I still sometimes suffer from a very short attention span, so I figure if you're anything like me, I'll say the most important things that I'd say the whole time I'm up here. And the first thing is that I am not an expert on Alcoholics Anonymous, on alcoholism, or on anything else. I'm just a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been asked here to come here and share on a little bit, you know, the way that the book suggests that we do, what it used to be like, what happened, what it's like today. And as you've already heard a couple people mention, you know, I'm not paid to be here, and neither is anyone else who comes here to share. And I want you to know that for a couple of reasons. One, because Alcoholics Anonymous is absolutely free. And we don't pay people, you know, for the work that they do in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's important. Also, you know, when you're sitting at the coffee shop later on, we have to sit in there saying, we had to pay her for that. So it clears it all clears it all up right there. I believe I was born an alcoholic, and I don't want to have a philosophical discussion with any of you about that after the meeting. It's something I believe. There was something wrong with me before I ever started to drink, you know. And I feel amazingly fortunate to have been born in a time when something called Alcoholics Anonymous exists. My grandfather died as a drunk driver in Ireland, killing a number of other people. My father died drinking in a hotel room alone. My mother has been in and out of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous with varying lengths of sobriety for 43 years. So there seems to be something genetic, possibly in my background. I believe that there was something wrong with me, and I believe that because, you know, alcohol wasn't my first obsession. My first obsession in life was suicide. And from as far back as I can remember, which is about 5 years old, I began to try and kill myself on a regular basis. And really, you know, it didn't start exactly at five, but not too much longer after that. I can tell you that there really weren't any days in my life before I came to this program where I didn't try and take my own life, put myself in a position where someone else would take my life, or pray to a God that I was slowly losing faith in to please let me die. Now, you know, if you're new, that is not everyone's story by any means. You know, I mean, I'm just up here and I'm going to share mine, and that's why we encourage people to go to lots of different meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, because probably one of the most wonderful things about Alcoholics Anonymous, I believe, is that we are people who normally would not mix, you know. So this is just, you know, this is just where I came from. I began to cut my hands and fingers and wrists with razor blades from the time that I was 5 years old, and to take overdoses of baby aspirin, which was all I knew about at the time. But, you know, it was really not a passing thing. You know, I mean, as I look back, I really wanted to die. I grew up in an alcoholic home. I grew up in a home with a lot of violence. There was a lot of different kinds of abuse and a lot of things that happened. And there were a lot of broken promises and a lot of things that happened in a lot of alcoholic homes. I just didn't want to be anywhere, you know. I didn't have any dreams when I was growing up. I didn't have any really when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous either, actually. But I mean, I just wanted to die. I really, you know, it was just like I was really pretty simple. I wanted out. So you can see, if I mentioned to you that when I was 8 years old, the first time that I took enough alcohol in my body that I could finally, like, it was like I could breathe for the first time. And I am so grateful to alcohol, because I believe I would have had to have been locked up in some kind of an institution, because you can't hurt as much as I always hurt without finding something. And I am so grateful that alcohol worked the way that it did for me. You know, when I was a kid, I was growing up in this alcoholic home, and I know today that most of the people I was looking at were alcoholics, but I didn't know that then. Before I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I never saw a man cry. I never saw a man cry under any circumstances. I've seen men shot. I've seen them stabbed. I've seen them arrested. I've seen their wives leave them. I've seen their kids overdose. I've seen a lot of things happen. I never saw a man shed anything even like a tear. And I thought that meant that men never felt pain. I saw the women in my life. I watched them walk through all of those same circumstances. Some of them were, most of them were very tough. But all of them had a breaking point. I saw every one of them at some point in one of those circumstances or another cry. And I looked at those two different groups of people, and I decided immediately which one I wanted to be like. And I spent my whole life before coming to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and some of it afterwards, trying to be what I thought a man was. And to me, a man was someone who cared about no one, who felt absolutely nothing, and if they did, they never let anybody know it, with the exception of anger and rage. That was the only emotion that I thought men experienced, and that's kind of how I wanted to live my life. I had a very serious problem, though, because I'm one of those people that I've heard Clancy, you know, when he'll talk about, I was one of those people that seemed to have been born without any emotional insulation whatsoever. So that when I went out there into school at 5 and 6 years old, and they started to tease me about being tall and skinny and having curly red hair, it hurt so much that I felt like I had been assaulted, you know. And so I found out about myself from my earliest memories that I was the thing that I hated the most and the thing that I could never forgive in anyone, and especially in me. I found out I was weak, that absolute strangers could make me feel something I didn't want to feel. And I never forgave myself for it until long after I was sober in the Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had to look at those old ideas of what's weak, you know. But at that time, I really was, I really couldn't stand it, you know. And alcohol and the chemicals that I was to mix with it allowed me to control my emotions. It allowed me to not care. I didn't care about you, and I didn't care about me. And I'm still very grateful that they worked the way that they did for me. When I was a little kid, they'd say, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" And I said, "A boy." It wasn't as easy. It wasn't as easy to do back then as it is today. But I was very serious. It wasn't like some days a nurse, some days a teacher. It was like, I just want to be a boy. And this really began to concern my family. And I was raised Catholic, and they began to take me to priests for free counseling. And then we were on welfare, and I guess the priest, I think, told my mom that we could go, that she could take me to psychiatrists and psychologists. I think we started with psychologists, then they moved me up to psychiatrists. I don't really know. You know, I saw a number of professionals. I don't have any kind of diagnosis to tell you about what they thought was wrong with me, why I hated myself, why I tried to kill myself, why I drank the way that I did, why I wanted to be a boy, any of that. Because I, you know, I felt about those professionals just like my friend Patty Hicks always did. I thought those people should have to work for their money. And I never told him anything. I never filled out one form. I never answered one question. I never played with one doll. I sat there the required 50 minutes, and when we were done, I just got up and I walked out. You know, a couple years ago, there was a movie called The Departed, and there's this one scene in there where this cop says to a psychiatrist, he says, you know what Sigmund Freud said about the Irish? They're impervious to psychoanalysis. You know, it was like, I'm not giving them any information, you know. And you know, and that was at like 7 and 8 and 9 years old. I just had nothing to say to these people. So I kind of had to figure things out myself, and the way that I saw things, since I wasn't going to be able to be a boy, the only option that I saw was to try and be a tough broad. And I spent all my time before coming, and again, a long time after I came in the program, trying to be what I thought a tough broad was. And, you know, I grew up in a town called Venice. It's a beach town in Los Angeles. It's a very unusual town. You almost have to see it to believe it. But anyway, I grew up there, and it was very important if you were going to be a tough broad in Venice Beach that you belong to a gang, and I did. It was important that you do a lot of fighting if you were going to be a tough broad, and I did. It's important that I always remember to mention that I've never won a fight in my life. But I never fought less than 5 people at a time. And after I had been sober, my sponsor explained to me that, you know, if you fight one person and you lose, people are going to think you're not a very good fighter. But if you always fight groups of 5 or more, nobody expects you to win. And they think, hey, you know, she must be kind of tough, or why would that many people have had to jump her? So it was one of those, you know, it was one of those things that I sort of figured out on my own. So I frequently walked around, you know, with a black eye or a swollen lip or, you know, whatever. And I also learned for me that I would much rather you punch me in the face than hurt my feelings. And you'll have to take it from me, I became very good at getting people to actually want to punch me in the face. So I really, you know, that's just kind of the way I lived out there. My mother, as I kind of mentioned, has been in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for many, many years. She was in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous when I was a kid. And, you know, it's interesting. I don't know. I'm going to go ahead and tell this story. I don't often, but, you know, we talk a lot of times about the fact that alcoholism is a progressive disease and that it progresses even when we are not drinking. And I think, just knowing me the way that I do, that I might have really had a problem believing that when I came in the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, had it not been for what I saw and experienced with my mom. My mom was sober at one point when I was a kid, and she was sober for at least 1 year, maybe 2. And she had a job, and we had an apartment, and the gas and the phone and the lights were all on. And she came home one night from a party, and she was very dressed up. And I knew that she went to AA, and I'd gone to lots of meetings with her, and I knew that, you know, she was sober. And she came in from that party, and she was very happy, and she was laughing. And she said, I had a glass of brandy tonight. And I said, oh. And I said, you know, Mom, I thought you didn't drink when you go to AA. And she said, it was brandy. Now, my mom was, you know, I don't know your area here, but my mom drank in some, you know, I mean, if I mention that I've seen people shot and stabbed and pool cues going through people's heads, you can kind of see that maybe a lot of brandy wasn't being served. So, you know, this was not my mom's kind of drinking, you know, so I didn't think that much of it. So whatever day of the week, I seem to think it was Friday, but it couldn't really have been, because the next day I remember I went to school. And I came home from school. So this is like, you know, just the next day. I mean, it's not even 24 hours. And I walked in the house, and there were 6 people passed out in the apartment, and bottles and all kinds of drugs and other things all over the house. And everybody was passed out. And that night, one of the guys, you know, came and tried to attack me in the room, and I was yelling for help, and nobody woke up. And so I kind of got out, and I spent the night somewhere. And I came back the next morning to get my stuff to go to school, and my mom introduced me to her new boyfriend, who she had met the day before, who had just gotten out of prison for killing his girlfriend. And that was in less than 24 hours, you know what I mean? And things had been so different the day before. So I know that the disease of alcoholism progresses even when we aren't drinking, you know, and I'm glad, I'm very grateful that I learned that. It's been important for me to remember, you know, over the years. I was brought to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous a few years later by my mother. Not because I wanted help, not because I asked for help, not because I admitted having a problem, but simply because she thought if she left me alone, I might get her evicted from another apartment by some of my behavior and the things that I did. And so I sat in that meeting that night, and the miracle of this program began for me that night. You may not identify with the things that were important to me, but, you know, if I had to tell you what I wanted out of life in one sentence, all I wanted out of life was I wanted the ability to walk into a room full of strangers and have everyone there back away from me in terror. Now, when you're 87 pounds, that almost never happens, you know. But at the meeting that night, there was a guy that my mom drank with, and he was sober. And he was one of the most hostile and violent men that I knew. And he was the kind of guy that when he was drinking and he came into the bar, if he wanted to sit at your table, you just gave him the table. You didn't try and talk to him and say, but there's all those empty tables over there, you know, because you didn't know what he'd do to get your table. And so I looked at this man who had achieved everything that I wanted out of life, the ability to clear a room and a table in a very tough bar, and he was sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It made a very big impression on me. I got drunk the next night, And then I came back to some meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I did not raise my hand because I wasn't an alcoholic. I was too young to be an alcoholic, and even if I was an alcoholic, I wasn't going to join an organization that was allowing my mother to belong to it. So, I spent a couple of weeks going to some meetings and talking to this guy, Paul. And I talked to him between the meetings, and I explained to Paul that I wasn't an alcoholic, that I wasn't really anything like my mother, who we all knew was alcoholic. I mean, she had herself admitted she was an alcoholic. She'd been in and out of AA for a number of years, so we knew she was alcoholic. I was not alcoholic. I was too young, places to go, people to see, things to do. I had my whole life ahead of me. I was absolutely nothing like my mother, who was very alcoholic. And he turned to me and he said, you know, June, I'm pretty new in this AA thing, and they tell me I can't diagnose anybody's disease but my own. He said, but in your case, I'm going to make an exception. He said, I've seen the way that you drink, and I've seen the way that you use chemicals, and I happen to believe that if you don't come into this program and take what these people have to offer you within a period of 6 months or less, you're going to be out on the streets, you're going to be shooting stuff, and you're going to be selling your ass. And I knew he wasn't trying to make something up like a school teacher might do about something they didn't know anything about just to scare the kids. He was just talking about facts, just talking about things that had happened and were beginning to happen in my life, you know. That I did not want to be an alcoholic. I did not want to have to join Alcoholics Anonymous. I could not believe that it could be that bad. And yet in that 2 week period of time, absolutely every alternative but Alcoholics Anonymous was removed from my life. By the time I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, the only person that I hated more than my mother was me. And I hated my mother for everything that had ever gone wrong in my life. And take it from me, the short version, a lot had gone wrong, you know. But I hated me even more than that, you know. And I didn't, you know, my mom and I had a very violent relationship. It was just the way that it was where I came from. And my mom did not think she had to be subjected to violent attacks now that she was sober. And she asked me to leave, and I left. The rest of my family had not spoken to me and did not want anything to do with me. I'm an only child, but my extended family didn't want anything. I wasn't allowed to call or go by, and I didn't try. I tried to get into a couple of drug rehab and alcohol recovery homes that were in the Los Angeles area. There weren't very many, but there were a few. None of them would take me, some because of my age and some just because of my attitude. And, you know, I'd been in a number of foster homes. None of them would take me back. And then I thought, well, you know what, who cares? Who cares about these programs and, you know, these people, you know, with the foster homes and my own family, none of that really matters. If you're a tough broad, the only thing that counts, the only thing that matters is your gang. And then one day as I walked down an alley, all five members of my own gang beat me up. And so I found myself sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I raised my hand, and it's interesting. I know now that the people, when I raised my hand in that first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, there were a number of people there who did not know about the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous, in particular the third tradition, the one that says the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. And the reason I know that they didn't know about that tradition is because some of the people knew who I was because my mom had been around and in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for so long. And so they knew how old I was, and they came over to me and they told me that they didn't want a little kid sitting in their meeting while they talked about serious things. And they told me if I came back that they'd get together and throw me out. And I know that those people did not know there was a tradition. I didn't know that either. And I just figured AA didn't want me either. And that was okay with me, because I hadn't wanted me either for a long, long time. And so I fell back on my number one answer, the answer I had used, you know, since I was 5 years old. I went over to a friend of my mother's house, and I went into her bathroom. It's the first place I went at anyone's house I ever visited, and I found enough of the kind of pills that I needed to kill myself, and I took enough of them to do it. And then I went to a noon meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and by the time I got to that meeting, I could not stand and I could not sit. I was laying in the meeting. I don't know about where you guys go to meetings here in Pennsylvania, but in Los Angeles, they usually don't call on the people who are laying in the meeting to share. They realized, my friend Paul, that guy was there, and he realized that I had taken too much of something, and the next thing I knew, I woke up in a hospital with a doctor giving me medicine to something to make me throw up and explaining to me that the pills I had taken were to slow down my heart. And had I been there 5 or 10 minutes later, I would have been in a coma that they probably couldn't have brought me out of. And I can't tell you why that overdose was any different than all the other overdoses that I inflicted upon myself. It just was, you know, because that's the last time that I took anything that affects me from the neck up. That's how I personally define sobriety. My sobriety date is July 13th, 1972. When I left that hospital, you know, I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got very active in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have stayed active in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous in many, many different ways throughout the years that I have been sober. You know, I was not excited about being in AA. And it may not surprise you if I tell you that I came into this program with a very bad attitude. I didn't like anybody. You know, I mean, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't like me. I didn't like my mother. I figured any other women around here had to be like probably something like us, and I didn't like them. I didn't want to sit next to women. I did not want to shake hands with women. I most assuredly did not hug women. And I did not like listening to women speakers, which always makes me feel better because I know there's never as many people listening to me as it looks like. Most of the men that I had known in my life were alcoholics, and they were extremely violent. Figured you guys were here. You're alcoholic. You're probably violent. I didn't want anything to do with you either. So, you know, I found myself when I walked in the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous that I didn't like anybody here. I didn't like men, and I didn't like women, and I didn't like me. But I went to lots and lots of meetings anyway. I went to 21 meetings a week most of my first couple of years of sobriety. I didn't do it because I wanted to get a gold star in AA. I had absolutely no place else to go and be indoors. You know, I am so grateful to the people of Alcoholics Anonymous who were here when I came in. So grateful to the people who tolerated me. And, you know, I was thinking about this, you know, just not too long ago. I was trying to think of how, I feel so lucky to have been, you know, to have been able to come into Alcoholics Anonymous and to stay sober from the first time that I raised my hand. I mean, I can't even tell you, you know, but it's not like I've been doing a lot of reading lately. I talk to a lot of old timers. I have always, you know, throughout the years, I've had great sponsors and spiritual guides. And I just don't believe that there's like a lucky stick, you know, like I got hit with the lucky stick and that's why I got to stay sober. You know, I don't believe that it's like that. You know, I was listening to, I'm going to go all over the place now, but what the hell. I was listening to a tape not too long ago of Dr. Bob, and it was in 1948. Dr. Bob had 13 years at the time that he made this particular talk. And he said, you know, when I met Bill, Bill had 6 months sober. And he said, and then, you know, not too long after I finally had my little, you know, episode and I came in, he goes, by then Bill had about 7 months sober. He said, and then we went to work with AA number 3. Now, Bill has 7 months and we've got 3 people. He goes, we didn't have a book. We didn't have any steps. We didn't have traditions. We didn't really have meetings. We didn't have a meeting directory, you know. I mean, what we had here was Bill. And we're looking at Bill, and we're trying to figure this thing out at the moment. And at the time, apparently, if I remember this correctly, Bill had an upset stomach. And so Bill would drink sauerkraut and milk. And Bob said, we weren't sure if that was helping Bill stay away from alcohol. So we made all the new people try a little bit of sauerkraut and milk. But Bob says in this tape in 1948, he says, today as I stand here 13 years later, he said, we know what works. We have a solution, you know, and we know what works. So I want to mention, I mean, as I've walked through my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous, I had originally hoped, and I sometimes even still have fallen back on this idea that there'll be a kind of like a magic shield that'll protect me from anything that would ever go bad or be hard or painful. That really hasn't been my experience. Mm-hmm. But, you know, what I do know is that, you know, we don't have to drink to start over. You know, and I have had to start over in a lot of different areas, a lot of different times, but I've always been able to find, you know, people to kind of help walk with me and show me how to start over in my spiritual journey here in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. So if you're new, you know, you need to know that you don't ever have to drink or live the way that you used to live, and that we know how to do that, and we'll share it with you. You know, if you'll find any one person who has, you know, been on this journey, you know. You know, it talks about in the book, you know, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. I mean, I have no idea where the halfway point is, you know, but I got to tell you, I'm absolutely amazed, you know. I came in this program, and with my bad attitude, I had a limited vocabulary when I came to the program. It consisted almost solely of profanity. There were a few exceptions, the and mother. I found a number of people in Alcoholics Anonymous who were very offended by that type of language, so I tried to use it more when they got near me. I didn't wear shoes most of the first 2 years that I was sober. It wasn't that I took them off to go to meetings. I just didn't wear them. So I didn't wear shoes. I wore motorcycle chains on my wrists and my ankles. I had a jacket, and on the back it said, do unto others, and then split. It was my own spiritual philosophy. I smoked 3 packs of cigarettes a day after I got sober. I lit all of them myself. Occasionally someone would hold a match, and I allowed them to hold it as long as they liked, but they never lit my cigarette with it. And after I'd been sober a short period of time, I took up smoking cigars and then later a pipe. And what I want to let you know, although this room is pretty crowded, what I want to let you know is if you choose to talk the way that I did, dress the way that I did, and smoke the way that I did, which you really can't do anymore in, you know, AA meetings, but at that time I was able to have an entire row all to myself often. And, you know, it really had to do with the fact that I really wanted to keep people away from me. And I think where I was starting to go, you know, is that when I think about the people that were here in Alcoholics Anonymous, when I came in, you know, I could not let people touch me. I needed my own row because I just felt like throwing up at who I was and where I had come from. And getting sober only made it worse. You know, it wasn't like a magical, you know, sort of a thing for me. I had never liked anything about myself. And now in sobriety, I was recognizing the things that I had done, and the remorse was incredible, you know. And so I couldn't let people hug me. I think some people can, and I think that's great, you know, and I couldn't let people shake my hand. But you know what? It was like, for me, I was talking with Sandy about this not too long ago. For me, it was the people that came to the speaker meetings, largely, that I went to. I went to always went to a book study and other meetings as well. But it was the people who came to speaker meetings, and they shared that they came from this place of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization where alcohol had brought them through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that through working these spiritual principles at different times and in different ways and, you know, whichever, but that they had gotten to a point where they could look themselves in the eye in the mirror, where they could walk down the street, you know, and they felt just like one of God's kids. They didn't feel better than anybody else. They didn't feel less than anybody else. They're just right there in the middle. And I listened to those people, and I never believed that that could happen for me. But I did believe the language of the heart of what had happened to those people, and I did believe that it could get better than what I was feeling. I did believe that maybe, you know, I wasn't going to be able to look in a mirror, but maybe one day when I was walking down a street and I happened to glance in one of those storefront windows and catch a glimpse of what was looking back, I wouldn't feel like throwing up at who I was and where I came from. And that was enough hope to keep me coming back to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I was thinking about it. It was like the words and the stories. They touched me, you know, and they still do throughout the years. You know, I feel so lucky to have known so many amazing, wonderful, wonderful members of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. When I, you know, would stand at the door of the Tuesday night Westwood meeting, I was the greeter. And I would stand there with my motorcycle jacket and chains and cigar, welcoming the newcomers as they came to AA. Sometimes as they'd walk past me, I'd sort of hear their sponsor whisper, "You see, if you keep drinking, you can end up like that." At the time, people were guessing my age at 37 years old. And I was 13 when I stood there greeting at the door there, you know. But I felt at least 1,000 years older in 1972 than I do tonight. You know, I don't know where the old, you know, the whole age thing is and all that, but I just know that I felt so old when I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't think there was anything that was ever going to be able to make that go away. I just felt so done, you know. And like I said, I still didn't have dreams. It wasn't like I got sober and had some dreams. I thought, I'm just going nowhere, you know. And I can remember, you know, anyway, I won't tell that story really, but I just remember going down and seeing Chuck C, you know, and you're like, I'm sitting there, you know, and I got a seventh grade education. I don't have any place to live. I've been turned into the immigration authorities because I'm illegally in the country, which is a whole other story I could mention. I've got some court cases going on. And I go to court and the judge, I'm sober, by the way, did I mention that? This is all, I'm sober. You know, I go to court and the judge orders me out of the state of California. Now, I grew up in this town called Venice. I ran away once. We never had a car. I ran away once. I hitchhiked and I made it like 3 miles east to Culver City. And that was as far pretty much as I'd ever gone. So, you know, when the judge orders me out of the state, they send me to see Chuck, you know. And Chuck, I'm sitting there, and you know, and Chuck says to me, you know, you're already everything you're ever going to be. You're not going anywhere. You don't need anything else. You already have everything. I'm thinking, let me repeat this really slow, because apparently he didn't get all the details. You know, it's kind of like, you know how it is when you're talking to your sponsor, you know, and let me start over, because apparently I didn't, you know, give you all the necessary facts. And you go over and you try and lay it out very simply for them. And then at the end they say something like, go to a meeting. You know, you're like... You know, like, it's about as helpful as if you walked up to someone and you go, what time is it? They go, it's a horse. You know, like, this isn't helping, you know. So, anyway, and so, you know, I got ordered out of the state. So Chuck used to love to make jokes. You know, he'd introduce me. He'd go, you know, this is my friend. You know, she's wanted in a couple states, not wanted in several others, you know. And, you know, and this is in sobriety. So, you know, my friends have to raise money and people have to testify that I've left the state, you know, of California. And that was my first plane flight. And this, you know, and so now I, you know, here I am, I'm, you guys are flying me over here to tell you stories like this, you know. Anyway, so I have a seventh grade education. I dropped out of school. I came into the program, as I said. I went to a lot of meetings. You know, we had a lot of speaker meetings, and there was a woman, it seemed to me, named Gail Wilson, who spoke at about 18 of the 21 meetings a week that I went to. And I thought to myself, perhaps if I ask this woman to be my sponsor, I can find out ahead of time where she's speaking and I won't have to go hear her all the time. And that's how I got a woman for a sponsor. Because I've already told you how I felt about me and other women. And, you know, I got to tell you, whenever I think of my sponsor, Gail Wilson, I absolutely think of that line in the book, which says, we are people who normally would not mix. Gail was about 3 times my age. She had grown up in the South. I hated people like that. She had a loving mother and father. I hated people like that. She had a car. I hated people like that. She had a career. I hated people like that. She'd gone to college. I hated people like that. What else? Oh, she traveled all around. I already told you about, you know, how far I'd gone in my life. So, you know, I hated that. And she not only did not use the same words I used, she didn't know what a lot of the words I was using meant. You know? And as if all of that was not bad enough, and I quite feel that it really was, she had been seen on numerous occasions in public wearing pink. Okay, I didn't even sit in a row where someone wore pink until I was like 10 years sober. You know, like nothing to do with the pink thing. So Gail became my sponsor, and her home group, which is one of my regular home group also, is the Thursday night Brentwood workshop, and I invite any of you to come. It's a fabulous meeting, great format. But anyway, that was Gail's home group. I would go to the Thursday night Brentwood meeting. I would see Gail, and I would go say hi, and she'd say, now look, June, please don't sit next to me at the meeting tonight. She goes, I can't take the cigar smoke. And I'd say, okay, and I turn to go get a seat, and then she'd say, and please, don't tell anyone that I am your sponsor. And that was fine with me because I didn't want people to know I was hanging out with someone as lame as she was, you know. So we would kind of meet secretly later, you know, at different places and talk about, you know, AA. And Gail wanted me to go back to school, to go back and get a high school diploma. And I did try to go back to school. I went to a lot of schools, even after I got sober. And I couldn't or I wouldn't. I mean, you can see where, as I've described myself, I might not really fit in at your local high school or junior high, and I didn't. So I really wasn't able to do that. And so what Gail told me is if I wasn't willing to do the footwork to get an education, that I was going to have to get the kind of job that someone with a seventh grade education would get. And that's what I did. I got a lot of different jobs because I was, you know, sort of like Dave last night. You know, I wasn't a very good employee. And I sort of would, like, I'd go to work. Well, I was kind of exactly like that idea of Dave. I'd go out to coffee with people as late as possible. And then if I had a place to stay, you know, I'd go over there. And then before I'd go to sleep, I'd say, hey, God, because I was testing this whole thing out, I got to be at work tomorrow. And they want me to work at 7. So if you want me to work there, make sure you wake me up in time to get ready. And God didn't seem to want me to work there or a lot of other places. I just kept getting fired, you know. So anyway, after Gail got me, you know, because she was not going to give this up. So Gail got me an opportunity to go to a business school and learn how to be a secretary. And if there's anything I never wanted to be, It was a secretary, you know. So I go to this little school because Gail wants me to. I start out, I'm typing 17 words a minute, I think, with 9 errors. I stayed there typing one day at a time. I think it was 14 months. And at the end of that time, I typed 37 words a minute with 17 errors, you know. And they told me I was not going to make it as a secretary, which I'd kind of always known intuitively, you know. But anyway, they said, now you have some other office skills and you can go out there and get a job and, you know, and whatever. So now I'm a couple years sober. And I've got to go out there into the citizen-y world. And to me, this was one of the hardest things that I ever had to do. You know, I didn't know a lot of people. I mean, I knew people in AA, but I'd never really been out in the citizen-y type world. That's where people work Monday through Friday. And, you know, they get weekends off, and then they wear certain kinds of clothes and shoes, usually. So, anyway, but I went ahead, and I started going on these job interviews. But first, you know, a bunch of people, women on the program, took me to, like, the Salvation Army, and we bought some stuff, and they gave me some clothes and, you know, took me to these, you know, and I'd go to these job interviews. And I went on a lot of job interviews. I don't even remember. It just seemed like hundreds and hundreds. And finally, I got a job. I got a job in an insurance company. It was so square, I knew Gail would be thrilled. And, I went to work. I worked really hard, and on the seventh day, they called me in the office. I thought maybe they were going to give me a raise. And they said, you know, we're going to have to let you go. They said, you don't have enough experience for this job. And they said, and not only that, you don't seem to have any common sense whatsoever. Now, and I didn't know what that meant, but I knew I was being insulted. And I was around 2 years sober at 21 meetings a week. I don't know what that adds up to because I've only got a seventh grade math education, but I had been to a lot of meetings. And I had been to all, I had never heard of anyone sober in Alcoholics Anonymous being fired. And so I went downstairs and I called Central Office and reported this company. And I figured, you know, we would ticket or something, you know, let them know. And they just kind of laughed like you and sent somebody over to pick me up. And now, you know, I have to go out and look for another job, you know. And I certainly don't feel very good about, you know, anything. And I remember talking to my sponsor that night and saying, you know, I never got fired before I came to AA. My sponsor reminded me I'd never had a job, you know. But I was very outraged all day long. And I go, oh, yeah, I didn't. Okay. So... Anyway, so now I have to go look for another job. And it's hard because I don't, you know, when I'm putting these clothes on, I mean, I feel like, look at the little Venice Broad in the citizen costume. You know, it's like Halloween. I mean, I don't feel like those people look. And I don't look like, I don't feel like I should be out in that world. But I'm going to go ahead and show up. This woman calls me up, and she took me down to an interview at a bank. I'd never even been in a bank. This was downtown, 10 miles from my house, farther than I'd ever been. And she's like, you know, you know, let's go in there and go in. I can't go and interview at a bank. You know, I mean, I'm a thief. I was stealing longer than I've been drinking. You know, I mean, I can't even go in a bank. She goes, oh, it's going to be fine. So I go in there, and, you know, right about this time, I'm working on my amends. And, you know, when I first came in the program at my home group, they used to say, you got to get a big book. It's really important to get a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. We sell that book for exactly what we paid for it. We're not trying to make any money. You come up here, and we'll give you a book. If you don't have any money or you don't want to talk to us, you can just go ahead and steal it. And, they didn't say that at every meeting in L.A., but they said it at my home group. And I had been stealing, as I mentioned, longer than I'd been drinking. But I'm kind of a superstitious person, I guess, and I sort of felt like if I stole the big book from an AA meeting, it might jinx my sobriety. So instead, I went to the library, and I stole the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous from the library. And while I was there, I stole a copy of the 12 and 12. I heard people talking about that, and I thought that must be important, too. So anyway, so now at a couple years, I've decided I need to make amends, and I've loaded up these library books because I always was a library book stealer. And I had this box of books, you know, great classics like Misty the Seahorse and things that I've been stealing for years. And I loaded them up, and I took them down to this librarian, and I explained to her that I was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was necessary for my sobriety to return these books, and I'd like to make payments because, you know, they wanted 3 to 5 cents a day, and I had some of the books for a number of years, and I didn't have any money yet. And she said, well, that's so funny. She said, you know, I worked at this library in Laguna Beach, and this man came in, and he said the same thing you just said, and he'd stolen the big book, too. She, you know, the Alcoholics Anonymous book. She goes, I guess you guys do this all the time. So I don't know. But once again, I wasn't unique. You know, I did find that out. So I went ahead, And so, you know, now I'm at the bank and I'm filling out this application and it says, due to the fact that as a bank employee it's necessary that you be bonded, we're going to do a thorough background check. And I thought, whoa, not me. I mean, first of all, they call one library and I have had it. You know, I did not like the idea of people looking into my background, you know, I mean, and I didn't have much of a background, but I mean, I just didn't want to be looking into it, you know, but I went ahead and, you know, it was maybe one of the first times that I kind of consciously remember going ahead and leaving, you know, just leaving the results up to a higher power and see what happens. And I turned in this application and they called me back on a series of interviews, and not only did they hire me to work in a bank, they put me to work in the vault. And I didn't even know if AA worked that good, you know. But I, the entire time I worked there, I never stole anything. I can't say that it didn't cross my mind. That wouldn't be true, but I did not take anything, you know. And around that time, I took a class in college while I was working. And this class, I took two classes, but one of them was called a dummy English class. And I took that class because although I was still able to read and I could read you the words in the big book or in any other book, I could not hold the meaning of a sentence from the beginning to the end of any book of any kind. And I was a couple years sober, and I really thought that I'd done more damage than we were going to be able to recover from, you know. And I heard about this dummy English class, and I thought, maybe if I go and I take this class, maybe I'll learn to read and my brain will work again and stuff. So I signed up and I took those two classes, and I kept going to school, and you know, then next semester I took a couple more classes, and I was working, and I ended up getting laid off from the bank. And I got an opportunity to get a job on campus in the cafeteria and one in the library, and then I cleaned apartments on the weekends, and so I was able to take more classes, and I got a grant, and I started to go to school full time. And three years later, they called me in the office and they told me I'd completed all the requirements for what they called an AA degree. And I liked the name of that. I had never wanted a college degree, you know. I took a test in the interim of that time that they call a GED, so that I have an equivalent to a high school diploma. And now I went ahead and I started doing the footwork after that to go on to a university. And that's what my sponsors had told me, is that I needed to do the footwork that anybody in or out of AA had to do to have dreams come true. And by now I'd started to have some dreams. You know, I don't know when I got them. I don't know how I got them. But I went ahead and I started doing this footwork, and I filled out the applications, and I got accepted at some universities, and I made a choice, and I went to a university, and I graduated from there. And now I had come up with this other dream, and again I was told, you know, I needed to do the footwork, and I did that footwork. I sent away a number of applications and letters and things like that, and it's been over 20 years ago now, but I received a letter saying that I've been chosen as one of 300 out of 3,000 applicants to go to law school. And I had always planned on spending a lot of time in court. But never on that side of the table. And, you know, I went to law school, and it was an amazing adventure. More so in hindsight, actually, in some ways. But, you know, law school it was not so much what I learned there, honestly, on an intellectual basis, but it was there for me that I began to accept this idea that I was one of God's kids. When I first got to law school, I was incredibly intimidated by the fact that I was going to school, and it seemed like there wasn't anybody in the entire school whose father wasn't a judge, and grandfather was a judge, and grandmother was, you know, it was just like this whole thing, you know. And I did not do well my first year. I was so terrified that I just went to lots and lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of meetings, which was good. But, you know, there were studying involved, you know, in law school. And I had a talk with my sponsor, Gail Wilson. You know, we talked about some things that I needed to do differently, and how I needed to show up, and so I went ahead and I started, and there I really began to see, you know. And Gail had helped me. I'm going to tell you a little story about how Gail had helped me learn this by this time. I mean, it had been, you know, a long time lesson. After I was sober a few years, I think maybe about 4 years, Gail began to sponsor a woman named Linda. And, you know, Sandy's met my friend Linda. And Linda is and was one of the most physically beautiful women that I have ever known. And, you know, so Gail's going to sponsor her. That's fine. I mean, you know, I realize the sponsor's going to sponsor more than one person. You know, no problem. But then Gail says to me that she would like me to be friends with Linda. Okay, now, Linda is a lot like Gail. Linda is a stewardess. Linda is gorgeous. Linda comes from a loving family that's kind of upper middle class. Linda has traveled all over the world. Linda has lots of jewelry, and Linda wears a lot of pink. Now, I'm sure you can see the problem. So I explained to Gail why Linda, she didn't even need a friend at all. I mean, you know, you can just see that someone like that doesn't need a friend, you know. I mean, why would they? And plus, you know, I'm single, and Linda's single, and this is a bad mix, you know, because the only thing that's going to happen to me is I'm going to get trampled at a meeting by all the guys who are coming to welcome her. You know, I don't, you know, giving her big books and such, you know. So, So Gail and I, we went back and forth on this, you know, and it's really one of the only times that Gail got really mad at me, and she slammed the table where we were sitting, and she said, "Did it ever occur to you that a person who's trying to kill themselves in a hotel room in Paris is having exactly the same feelings as someone who's trying to die in an alley in Venice?" Well, no. No, it never occurred to me. You know? And I realized, and I was to learn it over and over, that I was the snob. I thought everybody in AA was the snob, you know, and so I didn't like them. And then I realized that I was the snob. I was the person who said, "You didn't hurt as much as I hurt. You didn't come from where I came from." You know, and I was closing off all kinds of people, you know, and so I began to be friends with Linda. you know, I took her to, you know, lots and lots of meetings, and, you know, today Linda is one of my dearest friends. And when I graduated from that, with that AA degree, Linda bought me my first suit. And she bought me the first pair of shoes that no one had worn before me, because she loves to dress people. You can kind of see how that would go. And, you know, and when I graduated that day at that ceremony, they announced that I was graduating third in my class out of 485 students. And, you know, the thing is that there's never been, I haven't had a doubt, there's never been a doubt, you know, that that's just not possible for me. I mean, I'm the one, I had to sign up for the dummy English class because I couldn't remember the whole sentence. So something, and I believe that it was the spiritual principles that I was taught here in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, were working in my life, and I was learning to show up. So anyway, I went ahead in law school. And I did the best that I could, and I did fine. You know, I was scheduled to graduate in May of 1983. And it became very clear in about February of 1983 that my 48-year-old sponsor was dying of cancer. And I spent a lot of time with Gail in those last couple of months in her hospital room. We spent a lot of time talking about a lot of different things. And, you know, we had a number of different conversations. I'm sure it wasn't just one conversation. But basically, at some point in those conversations, I asked Gail, I go, "Hey, Gail," I go, "how come you agreed to be my sponsor?" And she said, "It's very simple." She said, "I was told to never say no to an AA request." And she said, "Because when you asked me to be your sponsor," she said, "I knew with your attitude and your background You were going absolutely nowhere. And she said, and in those early years, she said, I don't know if I have ever sponsored a greater flake, ever. Bobby, would you give me my water wheel there, right there, please? Thank you so much. She said, you know, you lost more jobs. I mean, you couldn't date more than once in a row. I mean, you know, she said it was really unbelievable, you know. And she said, but you always showed up for your AA commitments. You always did that, you know. And she said, and then I remember, you know, you called up at some point and you said, hey, Gail, I'm going to take a class at the City College. And she said, I knew you wouldn't finish. I mean, you hadn't kept a job, you know, for 6 months yet. You hadn't done anything other than your AA commitment. So she said, I knew you wouldn't finish. She said, but I didn't tell you. And she said, and then she said, you know, you took a few more classes. And she said, and then you called me up not that much longer into this. And you said, hey, Gail, I think I know what I want to do. So what's that? I said, I think I want to go to law school. She said, I had to force myself not to laugh out loud. She said, that's 8 years of school, you know, and you're a flake. And she said, you know, but she never said anything. And what we talked about was how come she didn't say something? How come she didn't tell me? How come she didn't say, hey, that's not going to happen for you. I mean, let's look at who you are. Let's look at where you came from. You know, come on. Wake up and smell the coffee here. The thing was is that Gail never believed in June. Gail never thought June was going to accomplish anything or go anywhere or have anything, you know, really good happen. I mean, she was like mystified herself, you know. But the thing was that Gail had been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous and she'd had incredible things happen in her life, things that just can't seem to happen. And she had seen them happen in the lives of others, and that's why she didn't tell me. I couldn't, or it might not be able to happen. Gail did pass away in April of 1983. I graduated in May of 1983, and I'm going to go ahead and I'll tell a little story here. In order to be a lawyer, you have to practice the bar exam. And take the bar exam. It's 3 days of 8 hours a day. So it's a 24-hour test. So I signed up and I took this class that they, you know, recommend and to study. And I went out there and I studied really, really hard. And I did everything that I felt that I was supposed to do. And I tried to, you know, go to my regular meetings and keep my service commitments and say my prayers and do my studying. And I showed up and I took the test. And I then you have to wait like almost 6 months. So, I took this test, and it was July, so the results come out in November, and I go to my mailbox, you know, and I get my letter, and it says, we regret to inform you that you did not pass. And, I'm like reading it like a couple of times here, you know. I mean, you know, I'm in AA. I go to meetings, you know, I say my prayers. I mean, this can't be right, you know. And I'm supposed to speak at a meeting that night. And it's definitely in the top five times that I most did not want to go, you know. But I'm looking at this telegram, and this telegram is saying way more, you know. It's like the end of November. And I have enough money on December 1st to pay my rent. And that's it. Now, I am, at this point, 11 years sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to go speak at that meeting that night, and I can't even put a dollar in the basket. I'm 11 years sober. I've still never been able to put a dollar in the basket. And this letter says, I can't even get a job. You know, and I am like, oh, my gosh, you know, what have I done here? You know, I mean, this was such a mistake. So I called my best friend in the program, a guy named Mike, who's a Marine. And I called Mike, and I told him about the letter, and he met me at the meeting. And I went, and I have no idea what I said that night. And then we go out afterwards, and, you know, we were talking, and I showed Mike the letter. And I said, you know, well, you can see what this means. I said, this means it was all a big mistake, Mike. I wasted all my time. You know, I borrowed this money. I mean, what was I kidding myself? You know, this is like crazy. I mean, clearly, this telegram is saying it's not God's will for you to be a lawyer. And he's like, well, let me see that telegram again. So I show it to him. And he said, well, I think it says you're supposed to take the test again. One of those, you know, like, well, let me see that again. I don't think so. I said, I already told you I don't have any money and I owe all these loans. And he goes, well, borrow some more. I thought, well, okay. So I did, and I went on, and I studied for the test again 6 months later, and I took the test, and, you know, just to let you guys know, you know, I passed. And I got to tell you, I felt much better about, you know, everything when I passed. I mean, you know, I just, I'd love to tell you that spiritually I took both exactly the same way, but it felt better when I passed, you know. I went on to get a job, and it's a job that I really believe I'm able to be of service, and I never have a day that I go to work where I don't remember where alcoholism takes people like me. And after I'd been at work there for, gosh, I don't know, maybe 7 years, my boss called me in the office. I work in a huge office, 600 lawyers, and they call me in the office. It's a county, you know, state job. Anyway, so they call me in the office. My boss called me in, and he said, we want to put you in charge of our training program because we like your attitude. Oh, God. Well, in 1972, nobody thought I'd get a job for my attitude. So I'm going to read something that I love from the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous right before I sit down. We have shown you how we got out from under. You say, yes, I'm willing, but am I to be consigned to a life where I shall be stupid, boring, and glum like some righteous people I see? I know I must get along without liquor, but how can I? Have you a sufficient substitute? Yes. There is a substitute, and it is vastly more than that. It is a fellowship in Alcoholics Anonymous. There you will find release from care, boredom, and worry. Your imagination will be fired. Life will mean something at last. The most satisfactory years of your existence lie ahead. Thus we find the fellowship, and so will you. When I came in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I mentioned that speaker meetings and people who spoke were really, really important. You know, one of those people that used to speak at meetings when I came in was a guy named Norm Alpe. You know, every time I heard Norm Alpe speak right after the meeting, I'd think, I want to join AA, and then I remember I already belonged or I wouldn't have been there. And, I always try to mention Norm, and I also steal his line, which he used to say, as long as you give people credit twice, you know, you don't even have to mention him after that, but I still always do, because he was really, really special to me. And his enthusiasm and his love for Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I'm fortunate enough to have, you know, people like Sandy and Bob Regan back home and lots of other people that have an amazing love for Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's just absolutely wonderful. You know, I encourage you, if you're new, to keep coming back and stay close. But what Norm would always say, he'd say, but for the grace of God, rooms like this, people like you, I could have missed it all. Thanks for not letting me.